get ready to jump the boards and go behind the bench with the Anaheim Ducks coaching staff. From untold stories to the X's and the O's, we'll explore it all right here on Behind the Bench.
Welcome into Behind the Bench. I am Alexis Downey, joined today by new head coach Greg Cronin. Greg, great to have you in the studio today, the Paul Kariya studio. What was your first impression upon walking in here?
Well, I took a couple pictures and sent them over to Paul just to let him know I'm here.
Well, I'm excited to dive into your story because I know that Ducks fans, they don't necessarily know all about you. And going into the season, it's great to give them some insight. But let's start from when you were growing up. Arlington, Massachusetts, right outside Boston. What was that like?
Well, it's interesting. I always kind of give people the roots behind that. Like, Boston's a very Irish city. There's a lot of Irish Catholics there. My father's family was all from South Boston, which has been Hollywoodized by Good Will Hunting and Mystic River and all those Departed, those movies that were still are popular. And as a kid growing up, I was very aware of that, of the history there and the culture there. And, you know, my mother was from Cambridge and, you know, again, both families were working class families. My mother had lost both her parents before she was 28. And I think people that are listening and have gone through experiences like this, when those events happen in life, people's view of the world changes dramatically. So we were always told as kids, you know, about the competitive nature of life and to be grateful for things. And, you know, when we're in Arlington, again, a lot of the people that were part of that history from South Boston were around us. The Irish are very tribal people. So, you know, my cousins and my family's extended family were all in the same neighborhood. And we used really sports was our primary kind of tool to advance. I mean, academics was there, but it really wasn't the primary part of it. I mean, of course, our parents checked on us and made sure that we were going to school and studying. But an event happened in high school. My brother was stabbed, actually, and I think he was in the 10th grade. I was in the 9th grade in a hallway. And it was just a fight that started, and it was, you know, it was going along for a bit, and he got stabbed. And then at that point, my parents were like, okay, well, we're not going to stay here. We're going to get, you know, Greg and Donnie into, my brother's name's Donnie, into a private school. So we went to a school in Cambridge, not too far from Harvard. And that kind of opened my eyes up. We could still, you know, play sports, but we got involved in a kind of a smaller environment. Like, yeah, the public schools were much larger, bigger classes. And, you know, we went to an area, a school where there were small classrooms. And make a long story short, that kind of opened up my eyes about how the role academics could play in your life. Mm-hmm. And I started to prioritize that as much as I did sports. And we played football, hockey, and baseball. And that got me into sports. And the academics was a real blessing in that environment. I learned some things I wouldn't have learned in public school just because I kind of learned quicker in small environments. And, you know, that's got me on the path to where I am today.
Was it just you and your brother?
No, I had a sister. My sister unfortunately passed away on June 19th this year. And, you know, I ended up going to a Catholic school my last year, and Margaret was a public school, then went to Catholic school as well. So again, you know, the same lineage with my relatives as well. And like a footnote to this is like, you know, my family didn't have a lot. And mm-hmm. so we were, you know, we were just, I think we were very grateful for whatever we did get. And I look back at people that I grew up with that really struggle with alcohol and drugs and a lot of the things that I think we're aware of now, the mental illness things that are a combination of toxic environments and whether it's depression or, you know, there's just a lot of that. I look back, I lost cousins in their 30s to alcoholism, heroin overdoses and mm-hmm. things like that, that, I was blessed that my parents pushed us into these areas that promoted growth from both academics and quality of life resources. And we were able to grow from that. And again, I look at life, you know, like you have these crises. We had Trent Sullivan in yesterday who was, you know, he was a 21st player and he had a heart replacement at a, mm-hmm. you know, as an infant. And then he had his kidney removed, and His message was about taking crisis and turning it into an opportunity. And I think that's such an empowering comment. The narrative behind him is so impressive. And to have him speak to the team yesterday, I'm always talking to players about gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Just gives you that drone-like view of the world and how we get so wrapped up in, I mean, of course, winning and losing is huge, right? Especially in a sports business, but about just being grateful for what we do have. And I tie my kind of events that happened in my life to what, you know, not as severe as Trent went through with a heart, you know, heart replacement and kidney replacement, but just how you can take those things and turn them, I call it turning chaos into opportunity. And that's kind of what I've used as kind of my core coaching values.
Do you feel like some of those things that you just spoke about, you realized at a young age, or do you think it took you some time over the years to kind of recognize?
Well, this is a great question, Alexis. And I think like when we're young, and I go through this now, we're just kicking the ages of these kids that mm-hmm. we have. You know, we have seven guys that are 21 years and under with us right now. And like your view of the world as a youngster is so different than, I mean, I'm 60 years old, right? So, you know, I'm basically a collection of the experiences of my life. I can't slice things out and say that's not me. They're me. Like how I manage them is what makes me express them, right? It's an expression of my experiences. And I think, you know, when I was a kid, I had a lot of resentment. I had a lot of victimized things I would use to maybe accept mediocrity in something I did, but I was always driven. I don't know where it came from. My brother, a very different personality. My sister was very different. But I always had a drive. I didn't know where it was going to lead me. You know, it's, mm-hmm. I ended up getting an MBA at UMaine mm-hmm. because I couldn't afford to get the MBA without the graduate assistant role. But I, as a kid, I think I struggled with things and just understanding, you know, like backpedal a second. So I would say if somebody asked me even 20 years ago, if there's one thing you could get in life, what it would be. And I would say wisdom,
mm.
you know, because that allows you to step back and see things in perspective. Right. And so to speak, in God's eyes, like, mm-hmm. why are we getting all rattled about that? And then, you know, there's this thing that I learned in the American League that I would think back as when I was a kid, you know, in my 20s about, you know, like people always measure people by their physical maturity. Play contact sports like football and hockey, you know, you could see people that were superior physically in terms of speed and strength and power. But there's also a huge part of that's driven by your mental attitude and your emotional maturity. And this thing that's starting to become, I think, an important part of the, in my experience, coaching is emotional maturity. Like guys can understand mm-hmm. things mentally, they can conceptualize things. But what I've discovered is emotionally, some people aren't mature enough to actually take the message and then convert it into action.
Mm-hmm.
And I have these kind of silly things that I say about you can't think yourself into good action. You have to act yourself into good thinking. And it's kind of a riddle, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. If you know, yeah, you've got me thinking about it.
Yes. And so again, so why don't they act on things quickly? Because I can see it and I can act on it as a 60-year-old, but a 20-year-old person emotionally may not be mature enough to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I try to like have a tailor-made program. Like each player's got to be coached. They got to be coached together when you're trying to create structure and strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But individually, I think they have to have a tailor-made relationship that's going to allow them to grow.
So you talked about how sports were such a big part of your life and your family in general. Going back when you were a kid, you know, playing sports with your brother and your sister played sports too.
Yeah.
Just how did that shape your relationship with them and within your family and, you know, just your growth too?
Well, we had a pretty black and white family. There was a lot of transparency growing up. Like, and I say this and it's an actual fact. And my cousins would tell you, like, we walked to school back then. There were no buses. It was we're only a couple miles from Boston, and you knew all your neighbors. Nobody locked their doors.
Mm-hmm.
And if you acted improperly, it wasn't your parents that were going to get on you. It might be a neighbor that saw something happen on the street and they'd yell out the door, hey, Cronin, knock it off. And mm-hmm. then you knew that if you didn't knock it off, you were going to get whacked, whether it was with a spoon or with a backhand. And that's not BS. That's how it was. And
yeah.
In school, you know, they teach you to grab you in public school, you know, by the elbows, or the nun would grab you by the ear in a Catholic school. There was a transparency and honesty that was visible every day. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but think about that. And I joke around and mm-hmm. the listeners that are in their 50s know this. We had phones that were stuck on a wall. And if you had like an 8-foot cord, you hit the lottery because you could at least get around the corner. But if you had a 4-foot cord, the whole family heard the conversation. So you weren't secretly texting people or living in shadows. There was just an openness to life, I think, that shaped all of our relationships within that house. And there was a consequence for behavior. So if you did act out of line and you didn't perform the expectation, then you were going to be reminded. And, you know, my father grew up in a family with five guys in South Boston, and there was a hard upbringing. And my grandfather really, you know, he was a hard guy. Like, he didn't even know. It's a funny story, but my brother and I would go over there, and my parents would go on like a mini vacation, and they'd drop us up at my grandfather's. And I was talking to my cousins at this at my sister's funeral last summer. And they said the same thing. You'd go in there and he'd be drinking, you know, whiskey and smoking cigarettes nonstop. We'd be on the couch just in a smoke-filled room in a three-family house. And then he'd yell across the room, black and white TV with three channels, "Hey, Sonny, go get me another bottle of whiskey." He didn't know our names, so we'd look at him like, which Sonny's getting the whiskey? But that's where we grew up, and that's... That's not unlike a lot of kids that grew up in that generation. And I think that, like I said earlier, we're a compilation of our experiences. And, you know, and I have to express the right, you know, from my experiences, express the messaging that's going to connect with my players.
Well, your father played hockey at Northeastern, correct?
Yep.
And you've had a couple of family members that have played at Northeastern. But did that motivate you to want to play college hockey, or was it just a personal motivation, just knowing that you wanted to go on?
Well, again, parents know this too, because they bring their kids to football practice and baseball practice. And why do some kids watch something, a sport on TV, and they're drawn to hockey? Some kids drawn to baseball. When I grew up, there's only three channels, and it was black and white. And TV 38 had the Bruins. And I grew up with Bobby Orr generation with Phil Esposito. My father was a hockey player. You know, I had uncles that played hockey and played baseball. They played sports, right? I mean, you drive by any field in Cambridge or Arlington back then, or South Boston, they were filled with kids playing sports. And I was, you know, basically drawn to hockey because of the Bruins, and my dad played. And this, again, is no lie. Like, you could go down, I don't know if it's the climate change or what, but you go down to any tennis court in Boston or any pond, and they were frozen at Christmas time. And you'd go out and play pickup hockey, just like today kids play pickup basketball. I don't know if they do that today, but they did a pickup soccer. You see kids playing soccer. So you'd go down there with your stick, and you had metal blades back then. There was none of this super fancy equipment. You had basically boots with blades, and you'd put a wooden stick through the stick blades, and you'd have mittens, and you'd walk down to the local tennis court, and you'd pick up hockey games. And believe it or not, I'm telling you, Alexis, back in the 60s, there weren't a lot of indoor rinks. So you learned to play outdoors. And then they started this MDC, Metropolitan District Commission in Boston. And to respond to the Bruins' success, they started building all these cookie-cutter rinks. It looked like somebody took a steel barrel that you'd see in a park, and they cut it in half, and they just plop it on the ground. So they had open ends, and they just put hockey rinks in there. So that just hockey just exploded in Boston, and I was in that generation, and I enjoyed football. I like football more than hockey, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. I was real small as a kid, so I didn't have a lot of punch to my hitting, but I enjoyed the game. I enjoyed the competitiveness. I played baseball because I didn't like sitting around. I didn't really like baseball. I found it boring, and I wasn't very good at it, so they stuck me on second base. But little footnote, I pitched a no-hitter in a JV game.
Hey, so. That's something to be proud of.
75-mile-an-hour fastball. So that's how, sports is a really integral part of my development as a kid growing up.
When did the idea of coaching come into play for you?
Well, you know, we were kicking this around earlier. I got out of college in 1986 at Colby, and I wasn't good enough to play pro hockey. They didn't have leagues back then. There was no like the East Coast League. The AHL was around, but it was probably only 18 teams playing hockey then. So there wasn't a lot of hockey for guys that wanted to keep playing. Now you can go to the East Coast League, the Southern League. And so I had a moment where I got done from Colby, and I'll never forget it. I was painting houses and building decks and roofing houses in the city and climbing up 34-foot ladders with shingled roofing. And here I am with this, you know, I got my Bachelor of Arts from Colby, which is a good school. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. And going back to the neighborhood, we didn't really have any lawyers or doctors or not that that's success, but, you know, I didn't have role models that, mm-hmm. you know, my father was a janitor and like I didn't have a lot of people that I could, you know, follow their footsteps to another profession. The networking wasn't there in my neighborhood, you know. So I just was a guy that had a degree, didn't know what to do with it. And I ended up going to the head of the Child's Regatta that some of the listeners might have been to. You probably don't remember it if you were there because it was a drunk fest. People would drink all the time and watch all these crew races that I actually watched in high school. My high school team had one. And we'd run around the Charles River for football. And I'd watch these guys thinking, what are these guys doing? It's such an easy sport. Little do I know how hot it is. Mm-hmm. But I heard a guy talking about New Zealand. And I thought, well, maybe that's my escape route out of here just to see what's out there in the world. Because I never really went anywhere mm-hmm. outside of a hockey trip, right? And I remember that, like within 48 hours, I bought a ticket. And I had to go through, went Boston, LA, Hawaii, Tahiti, New Zealand, Australia. And then it was like you had to go west and then east. You mm-hmm. couldn't track. You had to continue that direction until you hit Sydney. So I did that. I was gone for like 8 months and I went by myself, which was crazy. You know, back then, no cell phones, no ATMs. Mm-hmm. I went with American Express traveler's checks. I had like, I think eight of them, $100.
Wow.
That's $800 I had. That's it. And no internet. So once I left, I never forget, my mother and father and my brother and sister were like, what the heck are you doing?
I was going to say, what did they think about that?
Thought it was bizarre, you know, like nobody,
yeah.
you know, guys would go over to Europe and they do these bike trips and they, because I heard that from college guys and they'd go with groups and stuff. But everybody worked where I was, my friends were working, mm-hmm. you know, they were either painting, how they didn't have the money or whatever. I didn't have the money either. I just figured I'd work wherever I got. I'd just try and learn how to survive. And
mm-hmm. you didn't have a plan necessarily?
No. A crazy story. I was painting a house in Hamilton, which is a really nice area. And, you know, General Patton's got that's where he was, he lived. And I was up there painting the house. We were putting gutters in. And there was a lady that lived there. They were really nice people. She heard me talking about New Zealand because I was working before I went. And she had said that she had her husband's who went to Harvard. He had a friend of his that went to Harvard with him that's from New Zealand. Their family was sheep farmers.
Oh.
So I literally got like a, you know, like when you have those match and you still have them there, the matches that you've smoked cigarettes on, right? Mm-hmm. You take the thing and you rip it off. And she wrote the number on it. And she said, when you get there, you know, call if you're going to go.
Wow.
So I had the number in my pocket. I kept it. And then that's the only person I knew. Like I did stops in Hawaii and mm-hmm. I just kind of kicked around. And then I knew that I had to work because my $800 was going to run out quick. And mm-hmm. I made a commitment to myself that I was going to go for at least 6 months. And I was going to fight through the pain, you know, because it's hard. You know, you're isolated. You don't know anybody. You talk about vulnerability and introspection, right? I was 22 and I wanted to see my uncle Danny, who was a captain at Michigan State Hockey back mm-hmm. in the early 60s. He was out here in San Clemente. So I'd never been out here before. So I stopped in and saw him and his family, my cousins and stuff. And then off I went. And I tell you, there was at least a dozen times I'm like, I quit. I'm tapping out. I'm going home mm-hmm. because of the fear and the loneliness. I mean, I think back at it. I, you know, again, the number of experiences you had, the older you get, you know, they kind of fade. But that was a massive point in my life, just trying to understand, okay, well, how can I be talking about this with Trent Sullivan about turning crisis into opportunity? Mm-hmm. And without knowing what I was getting into, And I talked to the players about this. So you're in a situation where you can quit. But then, okay, what's going to motivate you to fight through that? Mm-hmm. For me, it was embarrassment. Like, so I'd go home and in my own little world, and people would call me chicken. You know, I that drove me, like, push through it. And I'm not a naturally, like, socially, I'm a little bit shy. Like, I don't like being in crowds. Mm-hmm. But in that environment where you're alone and you need to find out where you're going to live, like youth hostels, where's the youth hostel? Where can I go get food? Where can I get a job? I learned, I had a Vietnam vet, a guy that was in the youth hospital with me, and he taught me how to, like, you know, you go to McDonald's, if they're closing at 9, you can stay there and they'll chuck the hamburgers out. so you can eat for free.
Wow.
You know, you go to restaurants for lunch, there's a certain time where they're chucking food out.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go into the back alleys and we'd eat there. And then when I actually started working, you know, whether it was scraping barnacles off of boats and boat yards, trying to get paid cash, there wasn't as strict then as far as like taxes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then you learn when you travel that you can actually go to, say, I was in Auckland. You can drive a car from Auckland down to Wellington because they need the rental cars brought back to Wellington, which is the southern tip of the North Island.
Yeah.
You learn that. And then I got to that sheep farm. And I you know, I worked there and then I just learned. I learned, mm-hmm. I saved money. I bought a car at an auction. I took a bus back to Auckland, traveled around. I literally hiked everywhere I went. I ate and then I'd run out of money and then start working again. So I that went on for a long time. Then I did the same thing in Australia, but it was more outside of Sydney building like these retaining walls and construction sites. Mm. I talked to a lot of the Maoris, which are the native people, and that they would go to Australia because they make more money there. So the crowd of people I was working with were very similar to the people I worked with back in Boston. They were just different nationalities. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I was going to ask what kept you there, but you answered my question for me. Do you think that motive or that sparked an interest in traveling at all for you after that?
It created a confidence that I could get through just about anything. And like, if you go into a deep dive into that, I know people that are listening or people that have gone through this, and you know, you feel it physically when you're lonely and you're vulnerable and you're mm-hmm. at that intersection between tap and out. Like you feel it, like it just suffocates your insides. And then, and this is crazy stuff. And this is, I share some of the stuff with the players, like, you know, and it's like part of development. It's a big part of development is that DNA piece, you know, like I have good friends that are special forces guys and Navy SEALs guys. And I love talking to them about this because they're at the heat of that. You mm-hmm. know, when you go to war, anything we do is, come on. I mean, we're not getting shot at. We're not going to get killed in these events that we're trying to push our way through. And, you know, a lot of those guys will talk about the DNA is a big part of it. You know, you've got to have that in you to be able to persevere through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not judging anybody else, but the environment itself can help promote that growth. And, you know, when I went through all that, I could just remember feeling like almost sick to my stomach. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm running out of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how am I going to get from, say, I was in this place called Ekatahuna, which was in the middle of nowhere. You know, how am I going to get from here to Palmerston North? I mean, it's amazing I can remember that. It's almost 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then how am I going to get from Palmerston North, just a bus ride to Auckland to buy a car? Like all these things were just like these events that you just keep pushing through. It's what I said earlier. You can't think yourself into good action. You have to act yourself into good thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So the more I acted, the more the thoughts followed the action and they became natural. So the next event that could have been another, you know, could have been a dead end road, I was able to just push myself through it because my experiences gave me the confidence that I could get through these things. And it's not very unlike coaching when players hit these roadblocks, these speed bumps,
mm-hmm.
and they're searching for confidence. I don't care if they're first rounders or they're 5-year vets. I might be telling them something that's unlocking a door that they haven't gone through before because they haven't been aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bill Belichick used to say, you can't coach what you don't know. Right. So if you don't share this with the player, because it's a symbiotic relationship, they're the recipients of what you're teaching them. So if you're teaching them things that unlock these doors that to me are like these in my journey through New Zealand, Australia and all that stuff, these are roadblocks that are going to not allow me to grow as a person and to be a better traveler and be more resourceful, be more self-efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So again, speaking that language to a player that's 40 years younger than me. Is a challenge,
mm-hmm.
but I think when you gain their trust and you share your vulnerabilities, which for a lot of them is uncomfortable because you see your parents as invincible, right? And they're going to be with you all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I lost my parents 2 months apart, like 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
I'm sorry.
That's like, yeah, that's like when that happens that you realize like, whoa, like they're not here anymore.
Yeah.
Right. So these kids are young and their parents are there for them. And then for me, being able to share with them some of my experience, I didn't play at this level. I wasn't good enough. So I always tell them, ton of respect for you guys, like to play at this level,
mm-hmm.
such blessed athletes. I'm so proud to be able to work with players at this level. You know, it's a blessing for me to be in this area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I really wouldn't, you know, never thought of this happening when I was a kid, getting an MBA at Maine.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to share my experience with them in a hope that it creates an authentic relationship. Like, I don't have a hidden agenda. I'm a very transparent person. I'm very honest. Mm-hmm. So when the messaging gets to them and they know it, I tell them this, it's kind of really strange. I've kind of gone off the rails here on the interview, but when I tell them things, like, I tell them from love, like, I want them to do really well.
Yeah.
I come across as kind of a hot ass guy, and I can be a little sandpapery and stuff, but I have a lot of confidence through my experience that when I talk to the players, they may kind of like push back a bit. Because mm-hmm. most people don't want to be pushed into areas where they're not comfortable. But when I stay on them about it in a positive way, not in a smothering way, they trust the message. And mm-hmm. I think my coaching staff is really good at reinforcing those messages.
Do you think that some of these things that you've learned about how to coach players comes from all the experience that you gained over your 36 years of coaching before you got here to Anaheim?
Well, with unequivocally, yeah. I mean, like I said, I can read a lot, and I do like to read. I like to share stuff I read to the players, just about things that I might have experienced personally. I think from a communicator, when you experience things in life personally, they're more authentic, right? You can taste, feel, smell, talk them. Where mm-hmm. if you read it from a book, you're just sharing something you read. But I'm always trying to find ways to be innovative, and not just strategy wise, but psychology wise. And it's a balanced coaching, because you, like I always joke around, heavy brains mean heavy feet. You can't overload people because mm-hmm. they think too much. They don't react. Hockey's a fast sport, so they have to react quickly.
What was it like? I know when you were in Maine, you were with Paul Kariya too. What was it like coaching him, since we're sitting here in his studio?
Well, it's funny. I recruited Paul to go to Colorado College when I was coaching there. I was at Colorado College from 1990 to 93. And, we had a history of getting guys out of British Columbia. It's close, it's mm-hmm. an easy flight. There's a lot of similarities with the Rockies and the mountains in BC there. And Paul was obviously the most highly recruited hockey player in that year. I think that was in 91, 92. And Paul was good friends with a guy named Gary Davidson, who's he's been coaching a long time in Penticton. Gary's been all over the place since then, but excuse me. So I'm a competitive guy. I thought we had a chance at Paul. We don't get him. He goes to Maine. I had been at Maine to get my MBA from 98 mm-hmm. to 2000 with 88 to 90 with Dave Nonis, who was a GM here at one point. And I went to Colorado College for 3 years after that. And then I coached Paul at Maine after we didn't get him to go to CC. And he was only 18. He was a 17-year-old freshman. People don't realize that either.
Wow.
He had 100 points, very young, 17-year-old freshman. And I learned a lot from Paul. And I was a kid then, too. I was only like probably 25, 26. I learned a lot from Paul just in his preparation, how he was so driven. And we had a guy that Paul speaks fondly about, and Jimmy Montgomery does as well. It's Grant Stanbrook, who's Grant's probably 84 now. Brett Kurtz and I were talking about Grant. Brett played for him at Wisconsin. Mm. And he's just the guy's, when you think about Socrates, I'm not kidding you, Aristotle, he's like that person in sports. Like, he was so far ahead of his game. And Paul, I would say without speaking for Paul, Grant was one of the primary reasons why he went to Maine, because he knew that Grant was such an innovator. He was going to get Paul to the next level. Sean Walsh was the head coach, tragically passed away in 2001 at like 43. Mm-hmm. Sean would have broken every record in hockey as a coach if he didn't pass away. He was, again, another guy ahead of his time. Those two guys were the ones that got me into coaching, because we kind of got away from that question you asked me. And that's my relationship with those two gentlemen at Maine is what launched me into coaching.
How was your parents' support through your coaching journey?
They're very supportive. I mean, again, we had humble family, humble background. Mm-hmm. I always wonder what they would have thought, because, when I'm not inflating this, like when there were other people, my cousins were battling addiction and drugs mm-hmm. and alcohol and in some cases death, the guys were getting killed. I always wondered, like, I never asked them, but I always wondered if they were more concerned about us staying out of that. Mm-hmm. Toxicity, or and supporting just anything other than that, or would they have said, okay, I wish she had gone into being a doctor or a lawyer? you know, just those professions that symbolically represent success in our societies, right? But they, you know, they always, I think they applauded the fact that I was going to get an MBA. Nobody in my family, I don't think, ever had a master's degree. And I know what I was going to do with it. And I went in there with the focus to get an MBA and then go into business. But I got caught up in Sean and Grant's culture and environment, and I got the coaching bug.
With the business side of it, I know you were a part of co-founding the U.S. National Development Program. How did that idea come about that, you know, you wanted to help develop these young players? And I think that leads really well into the coach you are today too.
Yeah, well, that could be an entirely different podcast.
We can get to that another time, but you can touch on it for a little bit.
Yeah, so I was coaching at Maine. Sean Walsh had been suspended. Paul's teams won a national championship. They went 42-1-2. Footnote to the one loss, it was in overtime to BU. And there was no additional points, right? So that would have been a non-blemish in today's hockey, right? So it's insane. They didn't lose a game in regulation, 45 games, okay? So you can say they had a great team. Well, they had great coaching too. So I was not part of that team. I was with the team that when Paul was there for half a year, then he came and went to the Olympics that year.
Okay.
He was playing against Forsberg in that shootout drama. So, but then, so anyways, we kept winning at Maine even without the great teams. We kept winning. And I think 2 years later, we had like 12 or 13 freshmen and sophomore. We went to the finals and lost to BU. So I was at Maine during that time after Paul left. And then Sean Walsh had got suspended for rules violations. That wouldn't be rules violations today in the NCAA world, but they were back then. So I took over as the head coach. And I was there for a year. And then Sean came back. So the school supported him. We had to take some pain because they took away scholarships and postseason play. But Sean came back. And when Sean was coming back, Jeff Jackson, who was the head coach at Lake Superior State at the time, had been hired by USA Hockey to start the U.S. National Training Program in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Okay? So a lot of people don't know the story behind this. They say, well, why was it in Ann Arbor, Michigan?
Yeah.
Well, because Ann Arbor's got a great school system. Jeff's a very smart guy, a very well-prepared person, another Michigan State guy. And, you know, he had it all planned out. And Bob Mancini had come in from Michigan Tech, and Bob was really an up-and-coming coach back then. And so I was a rising coach. I was in my early 30s, and I had a history of being good in player development back then. So I came in and do the player development and coached the older team, which is the 1980 birth dates, which was like the Adam Halls and the, I think, DiPietro, Ron Hazy, John Michael Lyles. A lot of those guys went on to have long careers. But and then Bob had the younger groups with the 81 groups with the Andy Hilberts, Freddie Myers, that crew. And it's funny, I saw Ryan Miller, and Ryan Miller was in 1980, and we didn't pick him. And he's still pissed off.
I was going to say, picked. Did he say something?
Yeah, another Michigan State guy.
Yeah,
right?
All these connections.
Yeah, so anyways, we started it on an idea. And when I tell you how crazy this is, we were staying at Jeff's house with no furniture. He had rented a house, and I had just left Maine to go there. And that was literally napkined out. So the general idea was communicated to USA Hockey, and it was a constant battle for funds because you need money in any business. It was like a, you know, it was like a venture capital group, you know, starting a new company. And there were so many moving parts, right? Never been done before. So now when you call a kid and you say US National Program and you were there to see it, they're jumping to go to it.
Right.
The credibility is everywhere today, right? Back then it was such a mystery to people. So you can imagine me, you know, going to Boston to a Catholic school where they had Catholic school hockey was good back then. And we're trying to take their superstar. And that coach, I remember a guy named Freddie, not Freddie Ahern, but it's an Irish last name. He's a kid from Archbishop Williams. And he knew my father. And he's like, no, don't even bother. Don't even ask me. Like, well, come on, Fred. We got it. The kid needs a chance. And then that's what we got. We got resistance. Minnesota high school coaches did not want to lose their players. So we had to fight through that. And, you know, the school system, there was Huron and Pioneer. And then so the kids had to go there. The Billet families all knew. That was an unbelievable experience. And we were able to drill into development. The other footnote, people don't realize that my team played in the OHL.
Oh.
And I saw Pete DeBoer at the we had meetings in Chicago with the GMs and coaches, and we were joking around about we played his team at a bench clearing brawl. And we were like the stepchild in that league because we didn't really belong.
Right,
there.
Right.
So they would just take out all their bullies mm-hmm. and they would try and beat the heck out of us. Mm-hmm. I joked around. It was like the Christians being fed to the lions in the Coliseum. We'd go in there and the poor kids were just trying to get away from violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, we used some things. We used boxing and going back to those events that I went through mentally in New Zealand where kids were crippled by fear because they hadn't had to deal with that in prep school hockey. So we went through some boxing things that we couldn't do them today because it's obviously the concussion protocols would squash that. But I had a guy, Kirk Kulik, who you probably met out there, who was he kind of transitioned into a sports psychologist, but he was a real, very, he was one of my closest friend. And he was a big part of that. He was able to take the fighting mechanics, which he did as he had 100 plus fights. He fought out of Kronk Gym in Detroit.
Wow.
And he was into the UFC stuff before it became a sport. So he did surgery with our guys mentally, walked them through fighting skills, how to defend, you know, how to use the weaponry that we're giving you to counterattack that I still teach as a coach. Mm-hmm. And that same team, I was telling our team this the other day, the Ducks, that same team didn't win a game for like 14 games because they couldn't punch through fear.
Mm.
They didn't know how to. Then we took a break from the OHL, so we were able to get them. We literally fought in boxing rings, taught them how to spar, how to counter. Literally, guys
That's
were
amazing.
Getting bloody noses and
wow.
bloody eyes. And parents back then, some of them would call, what the heck are you guys doing? But we explained them, you know, the method behind the madness. And
mm-hmm.
then the next, we got like a month and a half break. We went back into the league. We played USHL games, went back into the OHL
mm-hmm.
mid-January, didn't lose a game the next 14. So those same kids that were 17-year-old scaredy cats went into being 17 and a half year old men.
Wow.
And they battled through it.
Does it make you proud knowing where the program is today?
Yeah, we got a bunch of guys, you know, the Troy Terrys, and mm-hmm. there's a bunch of our guys who played there, and Jonesy, and I told those guys, you have no idea.
It's changed a lot.
We did, you know, and the battles we had to fight externally through the OHL mm-hmm. and then internally with budgets and the question marks, is it going to work? And because, you know, USA Hockey is a real tricky organization. The mm-hmm. grassroots people are passionate about what they're doing, and there's this, you know, they're battling for funds and they're battling for their players. So it's a very unique challenge. And I think now they all embrace it because it's translated into not only, you know, success for the players, but also revenue for the USA Hockey through the success of these guys in the NHL.
Well, before you got to Anaheim, you were with the Colorado Eagles for 5 seasons. With that experience there, I mean, were you ever thinking ahead to, you know, hopefully that NHL head coaching job is coming? I know that you also were a part of the interview process for the Bruins, but did you think about that while you were there, when you were having that success, just getting, you know, at this point in your career?
Yeah, of course I did. You know, mm-hmm. it's funny, I tell the story and it's probably made its rounds around media. Like, I got fired from the Islanders in 2018, and Gar Snow, who I actually coached at Maine, coached at the Islanders, had been the GM. Hockey's like anything. It's a network business. So I
right.
had a close relationship with him. Jack Capuano, who's a great coach, was the head coach. And then the new ownership changed. Charles Wong, who I thought was a really unique person, a really, really kind guy. You know, he passed away a few years ago, but Charles owned the organization since, I think, like 2001, maybe. And he was kind of transitioning out from ownership, and Selden and family came in to buy the organization, and they had, you know, they had a very different view of how they were going to manage it. And it went through a rough year. So Cappy got let go. We went on a run at the end there with Doug Waite. And Dougie was assistant GM coaching at the time. The next year was just a tough year. It was just, I'm not going to get into that, but mm-hmm. it just went sideways, just kind of what happened here last year. But we had an older team back then. I mean, Stromey was in that group, but he mm-hmm. had been traded. So he got traded for Eberle, who's in Seattle now. And but that team was good, but we just lost direction. And we failed as coaches. And you know what's coming. So Lou mm-hmm. Lamoriello fired me. And I remember I was surfing down in Montauk, and he called me. And I was kind of in limbo waiting for my fate. You know, it's not a good feeling. And any coaches, every coach knows this feeling, being in limbo. Am I going to get fired? Am I going to stay on? Am I going to have opportunity to interview with the next group? Whatever. So I was like the Christmas Story, Ralphie in the Christmas Story that wanted his BB gun. I waited and then I got into the office with Lou and he, I don't even think he knew who I was, for God's sake. He just came in, he took over Snowy like a month before I was in his office, you know, and we had some common denominator friends and paths and stuff, but he told me that he was going to let me go. And then I said, okay, what do you know about me? I wanted to find out if he knew anything about me. I wanted to know why he was firing me. I wanted to know what, if he knew my body of work, what that was going to translate to when he walked me off the plank, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't.
Wow.
It's humbling. Very humbling.
Yeah.
At the time I was 45. I'm talking about 55, sorry. And I thought I was a real good coach. Mm-hmm. I had done a lot of things. You check off these boxes. You talk about, you know, having this job opportunity. And did I think about it when I was in Colorado?
Mm-hmm.
I thought about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You start questioning, why do some people get jobs and I don't? It's obviously subjective. I'm looking at myself, I'm a confident person. I think I've paid my dues, so to speak, and I literally have. If you just look at the boxes that I've checked from the U.S. program to college,
mm-hmm.
big building Northeastern from 3 wins to 25 wins, all these things that I'm proud of, that I put staffs together that can invest in that growth. So then Lou tells me to go back to the American League. And I said, Lou, I was in the American League in 2003. And I had a lot of success there. I was a coach of I coached the All-Star team, the Eastern Division, against Todd McClellan.
Mm.
And, you know, the next year was a lockout year, so it was kind of a goofy setup.
But
he didn't know any of that, of course. So, and then he was like, he's trying to get me out of the room and stuff. You know, he probably had checked this off, move on to the next one. And I just grabbed his boot and I said, I was like, Ralphie, no, tell me what I need to do. So I was looking for the BB gun. I was looking for the direction.
You needed something, yeah.
So he said, well, you got to rebrand yourself.
Mm.
I said, okay. And I walked out very humbled.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my board shorts on and my flip-flops. And he told me to come in what you look like. I said, I'm surfing.
No wetsuit?
No wetsuit. It was, yeah. And then, you know, then people know this. Then I went through like a good 6 weeks without getting calls back.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about humbling.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I had another 2 years of my contract. And then Gar Snow and Joe Sakic played together in Quebec, believe it or not, and had been friends. And Gar said, you know, I don't know if he wants to go back to the American League, but call him because that's the guy. They had been sharing the American League with St. Louis and San Antonio, the Eagles were. So they wanted to put it up in an area where they could drive to the Denver. So they picked Fort Collins because that franchise had been an East Coast league. And the owner wanted to move it up. And Craig Billington, who was a big supporter of mine, played a long time in the NHL as a goalie, was a GM of that team. So I'll never forget it. They called me. And then again, Paul Kariya and Joe Sakic are real close.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't ask Paul to call Joe. I had no idea there was a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
So they interviewed me on the phone. And then Joe and I, at the end of the interview, because they asked me questions and it was very matter of fact, Joe asked me, what do you like to do besides coach? I said, I surf as much as I can. And Joe surfs.
Mm-hmm.
So that ended up a conversation.
Oh.
And he said, as a matter of fact, I was just out in California surfing with Paul Kariya. He goes, you're kidding me. He goes, no. I said, I surf with Paul every time I'm out there. He goes, Paul and I are good friends. I said, how did that happen? He goes, I forgot they played at Colorado together.
Mm.
So he called Paul. And then Paul called me that night. It was a Saturday night on July 2nd. And Paul said, you're going to get the job there if you want it. I said, really? I said, he's got to interview 5 more people. He said, don't worry about the 5 people. You're going to get the job. And Joe said, he's going to get back to me within a week. Well, he called me on July 4th and he offered me the job and said, let's go. I want to do it. So then I had some other stuff happen that I really want to get into early. Mm-hmm. That was the year my parents had passed.
Mm.
And some other stuff had happened, and I had to do some deep dives into other areas of my life that I felt allowed me to rebrand myself,
mm-hmm.
Give me some tools that I didn't have in my disposal before. And I loved coaching in Colorado. I loved the American League. And my first year, I was a little bit like a raccoon in a garbage can. I was dealing with a lot of stuff with my parents because
mm-hmm.
my father died on September 1 on his birthday, and my mother died literally 8 weeks later. On October 27th, within 15 minutes of his dying.
Wow.
So I had that going on. Then my sister's issues were escalating. So during that year, I was just going back to that emotional maturity thing. I was just not like emotionally stable. Mm-hmm. But I, again, New Zealand things, just got to keep pushing through it.
Right.
You know, compartmentalize these things. I made some mistakes that year that I regret in terms of exploding, getting upset. Circle back to the players to make sure they understood where I came from. And I'm really proud that a lot of those guys, that I regret some of the things I did just because I was strung so high.
Mm-hmm.
And I circled back to them, and they still text me to this day. Thank you for your help. And I, you know, not that that's the intersection that they're talking about when there's like a disagreement, but mm-hmm. just that whole year. So again, like you learn from it. And then the American League was great because you're talking to kids that are younger. And I always make an expression like, so in life, like you're either running to a pot of gold, whatever that might be, whether it's money, fame, you know, vocation, service, you know, service unbelievable, right? People mm-hmm. that do where they work in hospitals, nurses,
yeah.
people that work to go to these foreign countries and help these underprivileged people. Like, oh my God, like people that do that. But that's gold to them. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you see people do that and you see the joy in their love to do that, like really that's like love, like that pot of gold symbolically is love.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got other people that are being chased by a lion, which is fear. They're running away from something, right? So like you're either running towards something or you're running away from something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're doing both. So kind of coaching is to create an environment where they're doing both.
Uh-huh.
Not running away from something because they're going to get bit, because they're running away from laziness or selfishness or a lack of discipline or complacency, right? So, you know, that whole dynamic, like I strung that together in the American League because they're running to the NHL. That's their pot of gold. Mm-hmm. And they're running away from the East Coast League.
Right? Yeah,
The AHL for them is right. Like where they want to be because the NHL is right
so
there.
Close.
It's
yeah.
right there. And so when you're a coach, you got to understand that dynamic. And you got to kind of toggle it like, okay, this is where we've got to go here. But it doesn't mean anything unless you give them like clear direction.
Mm-hmm.
So the direction going towards what they love, which is the NHL, has got to be clear. And the direction to stay away from the trappings of laziness, complacency, selfishness has got to be clear. That's where the accountability comes in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that the last time you were at Acrisure Arena was with the Colorado Eagles. And at the time, too, I believe it was also when you were interviewing for this position with the Ducks. Being back there, you know, for a preseason game, what was that a full circle moment for you just in thinking about it?
So funny you bring that up because it was there and then we were in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I spent a lot of, you know, days and nights in Tucson in
right.
that arena. But it's interesting you brought that up, and I didn't really – my thought was like, wow, like we had the series there. Okay, we were up 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And coaches remember – like coached thousands of games, probably over 2,500 games I've coached, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's certain games that stand out, right? So like that game – so I talked to Pat after game 3, which we won in overtime, 1-0.
Mm-hmm. That was a great series.
Yeah. And then, so we had a Monday and a Tuesday off, I believe. And that might have been a Wednesday too, because there was a concert there.
Mm-hmm.
I met Pat on a Monday. We talked forever. And then I got ready for Wednesday. And our goalie, Johansson, who just won for Tampa Bay last night, okay? Great person. Great guy, okay? Had a bad 2 games, okay? So he was great the first game when we won. He came in to relieve Annan, who's with the Avs now, in game 2, and we won that game. I thought we could have won game 1 too, but we gave up 5 goals, and Annan had a rough night. So we went with JoJo, and we won, I think it was 4-2. Then we won 1-0. Then the next night, it was a 3-3 game. We were down 2-0, 3-1, came back, tied it. We have a power play with 2.5 minutes to go. And the 2 guys that we get from the Avs, Hunt and Myers, are with us to join us for that game.
Mm.
So it changes the dynamic in the power play. We end up giving up a shorthanded goal to Alexander True and lose that game. When coaches know this, like I'm sure Blysma felt this on the bench, they were just hanging on. I talked to Troy Bodie, who's the president there. They were hanging on for dear life, and we blew the game. Then we lost game 5. So that's what was going through my head.
Mm-hmm.
The full circle moment, really not much. I really wasn't thinking about it. I was just thinking about that and then getting our team ready for that game.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought at all about what opening night this year behind the Ducks bench is going to mean to you?
No. I really don't think about that stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not just saying hyperbole here. I don't.
Okay.
I live where I'm at.
Yeah.
I focus on what I need to do today. I move on to the next thing. And I heard people talking about, you know, like watching games. I was in my office today with the staff about, you know, Vegas and, you know, that's an intimidating environment. It's the Stanley Cup winning team. I don't think about it. I think about what do I need to do to get our team prepared to give ourselves the best chance to win. And that means what I'm doing right now. Like it's an expression I like to, you know, kind of reboot myself, my thoughts to is where are you right now? Like be where your feet are. And then you can certainly plan for that event. But emotionally and mentally, like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
Right. So I just got to, it's like to focus on the process. And I think that's kind of how I've, like you asked about, like, did I think I was going to give up on being a head coach in the NHL?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of did after I lost the Bruins job, or not lost, I didn't get the job.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I did a great interview and it's hometown. And I went into a funk for a little bit there.
Mm-hmm.
I know Jimmy Montgomery for years. I coached him at Maine. And you get to that comparative thing.
Yeah.
You know? In my circles, it's like really, you know, unique thing. And they say, you know, resentment's like hoping somebody dies, but you swallow the poison.
Mm.
You know, so that's a dynamic I don't want to be in.
Yeah.
I don't want resentments. Comparisons are dangerous. I think society in general gets caught up in comparisons.
Definitely.
And it's not, to me, it's not how you should measure your life. It's like that person that's chasing service because they love it. What we do, and this is, you know, I don't know if it's corny or not, but we should do because we love things.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody has success, we should appreciate that success they have and support them. And it's hard to step out of that footprint where you're always, this whole world today is about comparisons, right? What kind of car does somebody have? What's their jewelry? What's their clothes? You know, and I just think when you live in that dynamic, how are you ever going to be happy?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Well, I know one thing that makes you very happy, you've touched on it, is surfing. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about that before I let you go. When did you start that hobby?
So I've been a sober person for 25 years. Okay. And that's, and, you know, my community that I grew up in, I made a decision that I can't participate in that lifestyle. And the interesting thing is people that don't drink a drug and stuff, people that are sober people, when they stop, there's this big void in your life. So whether you are physically drinking, right, or whatever your choice is for addiction, when you carve that out, there's a space there. Okay. So then you have the space. Now it's not just the actual drinking and drugging. It's what goes on before that. Right. So it's called stinking thinking, right? So you're stinking thinking, which is like, what am I going to do at 6 o'clock tonight to get, you know, my thing on, right? So whatever that is. So when you carve that space out of your life, you need to fill it with something healthy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's no different than, I always tell the players, like, bad habits are like addiction, right? But they haven't turned deadly, right? So addiction is just really deadly habits. So when you carve those habits out, what are you going to do with your time? And it's got to be healthy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sobriety is a spiritual program, right? And that's why we have higher powers.
Right.
So when you find time, empty spaces can be deadly, okay? Because, again, it goes back to the same habits. If you spend 60% of your time thinking about drinking or drugging and you end up in this space, well, that 60% is still there. So there's this thing, you arrest it, so you stop it. This is what sobriety is about in AA and stuff. You stop it, which is by you stop drinking. You either go to treatment facilities or you go to meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And then you build a program into it. And the program has paths you follow, which is a 12-step program in big books. Then it has these ancillary things that, to me, in my world, were very critical. So in addition to doing that, what are you doing to build faith, energy, positive energy, mm-hmm. spirituality, service to other people? That's why you have sponsorship, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you do these things repeatedly, you become them. It's another one of those riddles, like you are what you repeatedly do. So I would find spaces where I'm like, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I'd start running the beaches in Long Island. So I was, my community there started in Michigan with my sponsor, who's a great person. That was the U.S. program, and then went to New York with me. Okay. And I would run the beaches, and I was like Forrest Gump. I just keep running. I don't even like running, but I kept running because I know if I didn't do something, there's this thing, it's a very, very common thing. Move a muscle, change a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Move a muscle, change a thought. that's going back to AA back in the 1930s, okay? You get up and do something different, your brain chemistry changes like that, okay? So I just knew that. I just knew these things. Pick up the phone, not a drink. I would do them. These signs, all I just keep doing them.
Yeah.
Keep doing them. So then I thought, I'd run the beach along. I see these guys surfing. There's no waves in Boston growing up. You go to Revere Beach, it's just seaweed and trash, right?
Yeah.
So I watch these kids surf. And I'm like, wow, that looks really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So when it, like I was, what at the time, mm-hmm. I think I was like 34 or something, 35. So then I was like, I got to learn how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the joy that people had surfing. And I talked to the surfers. And, you know, I'm an assistant coach with the Islanders, and they're like, what's this guy all about? You know, like, so I asked them questions. I went down to the surf shop, bought a Hobie slug. You guys in the West Coast probably don't know that, but that's a Long Island board.
I was thinking, big, I was like, what board. Is that?
I actually have one now. I have a stand up now. It's a Hobie board. And so I just got into it. And like I said earlier, like I get into things and I'm determined to be really good at it. And I'm not really good at it. I'm good enough that I can surf, you know, well overhead waves. And mm-hmm. I've got into stand up paddle boards with Paul. I actually was telling somebody the other day, I hit up the guys I was golfing with in the tournament. I was in El Salvador surfing, and I caught my nose hit the water, like I got plunged forward, and it was it was like a head high day in El Salvador, but El Salvador's beaches aren't like Costa Rica. There's a lot of rocks, cobblestones, and mm-hmm. my chest hit a stone.
Mm.
So I paddled out, and my chest was throbbing. And
yeah.
my bone probably got bruised.
Mm-hmm.
So I was out there for like 5 days, and I couldn't surf because I couldn't lay on the board proning. So yeah. I saw a guy where I was staying who was stand-up paddling. I never saw that before. I was like, what the heck is that? So mm-hmm. I went out and asked him, and he gave me his board to try. I said, this is really cool. So I got into that, too. That was like probably 6 years ago. So I go out in the water as much as I can. Anybody that surfs knows it. Problem now is it's too many people are surfing, so there's too many crowds.
you got to find your spots out here. It is tough. I get that.
Do a shout out for San Onofre. You can go down the southern part and it's just stand-up paddle mm-hmm. guys. But, I get it. You know, I was in Hawaii last summer. There was a huge swell there that came in. It was the biggest swell in Maui in like 30 years, and Lahaina tragically got burnt.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a tremendous 3 days out there, but it was stand-up paddling and there was prone surface there, but everybody got along. So, yeah, I mean, surfing's supposed to be a kind of a nirvana experience. It shouldn't be about arguing and yelling. But when you have crowds, that stuff happens. But mm-hmm. I've never really had a problem with that. I really enjoyed it. It's a very spiritual experience for me. It kind of feeds my sobriety.
Well, Greg, I hope you are able to get out in the water soon. I know you've been pretty busy as we get ready mm-hmm. for this season, but I have to tell you, this has been so wonderful having you on Behind the Bench and just getting to know your story. And I thank you for coming in today. Very excited to have you here in Anaheim.
Thank you. You probably have a couple podcasts out of this one session.
Yeah, I got a lot of info now, and I yeah. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is an Anaheim Ducks original production on DuckStream.